do with the vicarious liability portions of the Professional Corporations Act, but we're not dealing with that. All we're saying is, in this, is that if you are a lawyer and you are going to incorporate, you should do so under the Professional Corporations Act, not the Business Corporations Act. Mr. Chairman, I frankly can't tell you what the...
Because that's, you don't get many, you don't get 8 negative votes in the Senate when the Republicans vote as a block over there. In any case, that's not probably not fair to ask you folks.
Well,
to talk
I'm sorry, I can't tell you. I don't know.
There'd have been a reason.
Yeah.
Olson must have lobbied the bill.
That's all right. In any case, Mr. President, do you have anything to add to that?
Only here to respond to questions. You've got a busy agenda. Housekeeping.
It may have had something to do with the fact that it requires, not it requires, but it reiterates again that attorneys shall never reject for personal consideration the cause of the defenseless or the oppressed. So you never know. That might have got some fire for somebody. Some people specialize in that. It's called pro bono. Fair to collect your fee. Okay, any questions from members of the committee?
Good bill, Shapiro.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, it's just got such a nice relating clause. It's just...
You're being tempted beyond that which you prepare? Relating to the Oregon State Bar. Oh, no. Not work session yet.
I know.
It'd be a technical amendment in the poll.
Right.
Let's keep it on the issue at hand now.
Mr. Chair?
Any case, any further questions from the members? Representative Bryan.
Just to clarify, this bill continues the current practice, is that correct? Continues the current practice that attorneys must either practice professional or the professional corporation, either like a partnership or professional corporation. Is that correct? It prohibits. I'm trying to sort through this real quickly. I haven't just received some of this material. Just trying to figure out what the bill does.
Speakerman, why don't you add?
As far as the professional corporation, the Section 9, it simply provides that if a lawyer is going to incorporate for the purposes of providing legal services, they must incorporate under the Professional Corporations Act, whatever that act provides. That they cannot, that is up before the legislature at this time. That they cannot incorporate under the Business Corporations Act, which is our understanding the legislature did not intend to include professionals in that. If you've got a Professional Corporations Act and a Business Corporations Act, it's our position professionals ought to be in the Professional Corporations Act. It's that simple.
Chair, Representative Bryan's still not done, then Representative Clark.
About the issue of maintaining the confidences of clients.
Yeah, there you go.
Page 2, line 27.
Section 5 takes out the language that says, maintain inviolate the confidence and at every peril to the attorney preserve the secrets of the clients of the attorney. And that language is coming out.
Seems fairly fundamental. Is that housekeeping?
We're not asking that be removed from an obligation of an attorney. And I'll let Mr. Reamer explain what we're doing, and it isn't going to be result in that much of a change. The obligation will still be there. George?
Yes, George Reamer with the Oregon State Bar. This merely eliminates the statutory reference, but we still have the disciplinary rule, which sets out the same requirement with some delineated exceptions. What has occurred is that the statute does not indicate the exceptions, and in essence, we end up having an inconsistency, and that was referenced in a recent Oregon Supreme Court case. So we are going to be relying on the disciplinary rule as opposed to the statute.
So you don't end up having to basically incorporate the entire disciplinary code in the statute?
Right. That's already adopted under a separate statute, 9.490, and it's already a code that has been approved by the membership in the Supreme Court, and it sets out some exceptions. In essence, the statute makes it very comprehensive that there are no exceptions, yet we have the disciplinary rules that provide certain exceptions. We just want to make sure that we have consistency there, because the exceptions are well-grounded in policy considerations and have been in existence in Oregon since the code was adopted in 1971.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow.
Keep going.
Some of the exceptions being child abuse reporting.
That is under a separate statutory requirement, correct?
What else?
I've got
Possibility of reporting the client's intention to commit a crime, a situation where a client would consent to the revelation of a confidence or secret, and a couple of others. We have the disciplinary rule available if you'd like to see it.
The other two, if I might, are if a court orders an attorney to reveal it, or if it's necessary to protect the client's interest. And the last one would be the last exception that's listed in the disciplinary rules is that if it is necessary for a lawyer who has been sued by a client to reveal that to defend himself. And those are the only exceptions. So you would have, with those four exceptions, you would have still in place exactly the same requirement to maintain the confidences and the secrets.
Mr. Chair, just one comment, I suppose. With some hesitation, I will support that portion of the bill. It seems to me, though, that ORS 9.460 kind of sets out some of the cornerstones of the practice of law. Supports the Constitution, causes the defenseless or the oppressed. I mean, there's some things in there that are fairly fundamental, and it's not without some dis-ease that I will vote to pull out that portion of the statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Millar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reamer, on page 1, line 24, the addition of the words, and fit to practice law.
Yes.
What's the reason for that addition?
Essentially, we're trying to synchronize the bar rules of procedure, the admission rules, and the statute. Though that requirement is essentially already in those other sets of rules, and they have been applied by the Supreme Court in its admission decisions. And we're just trying to make sure that there's a consistency throughout the statutory and procedural rules on this subject.
So it's not a lack of confidence that those who are now practicing were unfit?
Pardon?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Emerson, then Representative Bell.
I will just tell you that I'll be moving to add to ORS 9.460 print 3 a list of whatever the exceptions were, six exceptions you set out there, because I think this is such an important thing that I wouldn't want there to be any doubt that it had to be maintained. And since the bar can change its code of conduct any time without the legislature's okay, I think this is important enough that we keep it in here. Another concern I've got is if a lawyer didn't disclose a client's secret for some reason and someone got harmed because of that failure to disclose, without this protection in the statute, it may be that the person harmed could sue the attorney for not revealing the thing. And I'd say all that the last question is, first off, to get your response to that whole package, but secondly, you mentioned that somehow in some other statute there's these exceptions are already listed somewhere?
No, it's in the Oregon Code of Professional Responsibility, which are all of the disciplinary rules that lawyers have to comply with, and those are adopted by the membership and then approved by the Supreme Court. So I guess maybe to address your first concern, the Supreme Court has to approve any change, and so there is that oversight and evaluation before any change is made to any of the disciplinary rules. We're just trying to avoid having lawyers find themselves at odds, either complying with the DR, maybe feeling that there's a legitimate application of an exception, but then having the statute say that you cannot reveal anything, and there's an inconsistency, and it's not fair to lawyers to not know really what they're supposed to follow.
Right, and so we can fix that by making the statute this comport with the rules, the code of conduct.
You could certainly add some provisions such as shall maintain confidences and secrets consistent with the disciplinary rules adopted pursuant to ORS 9.49.
No. Shall maintain the confidences except in the following instances, and then list the six or whatever you've got in your rules right now.
Well, that kind of ends up codifying the disciplinary rules.
What I'm saying is I think this is important enough that I'd just soon do it that way as opposed to to leaving it open for change without our approval later. Okay, that's fine.
You want anything for you?
Nope. Go ahead.
Okay, Representative has a question, but do you have a comment to that, Mr.?
Just anecdotal information relative to that. That would be ease a good many lawyers out there in terms of, I think that the concern that you are emanating, Representative Johnson, are in fact concerns of some practicing lawyers. I took a swing last week through Eastern Oregon and talked to about four county bar associations, and I was met by a lawyer who had at the bar, Baker City Bar Association, Mr. Sylvan, who wanted to tar and feather me, and because he thought that we were doing away with the privilege totally. And I explained to him the same thing that Mr. Reamer has already explained. So I think that, you know, I don't think we would, it does not do violence to what we're trying to accomplish. And if you're more comfortable, we certainly wouldn't have any quarrel with that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Edmondson?
Mr. Reamer, I'm looking at the statutory code of professional conduct, which where the amendment would go to. And I see it in 9460 in the duties of the attorneys, which include, among others, the maintaining of confidence, as well as under 9490 on the rules of professional conduct, that the arbiter of those of violations in both cases is the Supreme Court under the provisions of 9527. So whether we have it in the professional rules of conduct or in the statute, it goes, violations all go to the same place.
Correct.
That's the Supreme Court. Now I wonder if, I'm just sort of putting on my my amendment hat here, what would be your reaction if we were to deal with section 9527 and leave in the duties of the attorneys as they are presently stated? And because if, when I read down here in 527, under where the Supreme Court may discipline, suspend, disbar, reprimand, or whatever, under section 5 it says, a member is guilty, an attorney is guilty of a willful violation of 460. Then I go down to 7, where the rules of conduct, and it says, they may discipline if the member has violated, without regard to whether it's willful or not, the rules of 490. So in order, as it says now, for to be disciplined for violating a confidence, it must be a willful violation of the confidence, as opposed to violating the disciplinary rule, which is simply you break it, you pay. Now, if we were to say under Section 5 the willful violation, that a violation of the duties of attorneys is not willful if it is in accordance with the disciplinary rules, I think we've solved the problem without taking out of the statute the confidence law, which we all, I think, feel as attorneys as well as legislators is very important. At the same time, we would not be putting into the statute the disciplinary rules, which by their nature are, I think, a function of the branch of government controlled by the Supreme Court, not the legislature. So I'm very hesitant to have the legislature draft disciplinary rules. I think it's a violation of separation of powers, frankly. And I would think that perhaps if we were to simply maybe add a sentence to Section 5 of 527, saying that a violation is not willful if it is in accordance, if it is in the execution the professional code of conduct, that we've solved both problems without having to the evils of having the legislature write disciplinary rules for attorneys. What's your reaction to that long preface?
It's too complicated.
I'm trying to, I guess, get a handle on the change to 5.
It says it really isn't a change. It simply says, right now it says, discipline may occur if, quote, the member, the attorney, is guilty of willful violation of any of the provisions of 9460, which includes the one you're trying to delete. I'm just saying that if that if it's a willful violation, would be one which is additionally violates the Code of Professional Conduct, then we would interpret maintaining inviolate the confidence at every peril of the attorney and preserving the secrets of the client of the attorney. Well, maybe it's not a secret if it's information which statutorily, for example, reporting child abuse or something like that, that's not a societal secret. We don't recognize it as a secret. Or the confidence of the client wouldn't be in the confidence of the client if the client has waived it and allowed the disclosure, for example. So you could interpret both those statutes consistently, or that statute consistent with the disciplinary rule. I was trying to take a different cut at this pitch.
I guess I'd have to think that one through.
Well, I would encourage you.
I think the Code of Professional Responsibility does have varying standards of culpability. Right. So it isn't necessarily correct that just by violating a code provision that you'd be guilty of it.
But that's what the statute said.
Well, no, I understand that the statute says that you have to, there is a basis for discipline for a willful violation of 9.60. But that's separate from the code, which
correct.
You can be disciplined for under subsection 7.
Correct.
And then you have to look to the code for the individual rule and whether or not there's an intent standard or a knowledge standard or a negligence standard or a per se a duty to comply.
Well, the only, what I'm, the inconsistency, if Mr. Chair, I think I can get this to closure. The problem that you see is an inconsistency between 460 sub 3.
Right.
And the disciplinary code.
Right.
That the disciplinary code excuses some breaches of confidence in specific situations. I'm just saying that where those situations arise, that would not be considered willful violation of that section. Willful meaning...
Well, that, I see your point, that it, willful would have to be some kind of additional bad motive or intention, and opposed to just complying with one of the exceptions. The only problem with that is I think the recent case that I mentioned, and I can get you the citation, the court doesn't necessarily get to the issue, but they raised the concern that there appears to be the inconsistency between what the statute says and what the DR permits to be disclosed, and we're just trying to avoid lawyers having to worry about that.
Well, I'm as sympathetic to lawyers worrying as anyone in the room, because I do probably more of it, or at least as much as Representative Clark does. But I and Mannix is here
worrying?
Now too. So worrying. So, but I think that if we were to make such an amendment with that specific purpose intent, it might maybe the court would pay attention.
I guess in a sense, what you're saying is there is no inconsistency because under the subsection 5, you have to show willfulness. That's a good point. I don't know that it's been tested.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Fraser, do you have a response to the Representative Mannix?
Anecdotal information, if I may, and I would ask to supplement the record to the extent that when I was in Baker, Judge Milo Pope was there, and Judge Pope allowed is that he had spent an extra 5 weeks in trial because of that particular statute. And I would just submit to you that if you would look at it in light of the fact that who exercises the privilege. Under the evidence code, the client exercises the privilege. What happened, I think, and I say I think, and I, the reason I would ask to supplement the record is that I think the attorney was involved in a murder case, and as the judge put it to the general membership meeting in Baker, that he had to let the attorney, quote, out of the case, unquote. Now, I don't know if the attorney was, that's why I'm a little hesitant to even to talk about it, but and that's why I'd ask to, if we could supplement it from something from Judge Pope to say explicitly. But my point is that under, it sounded to me as he was discussing it that it was being misused. The attorney was exerting it as opposed to the client.
That's a good point. Very
well. Okay. And under 9.14, it is on the attorney not to disclose as opposed to the client being able to waive it. That's why Representative Johnson's approach might be, if you want a comfort zone, that might be the comfort zone. But because that excludes disciplinary procedures and related events. Now, I don't pretend to know, and I hope you understand, that I'm talking from incomplete information, which I don't like to do. But it was enough. His comment was it took him 5 extra weeks in this trial. And I certainly would ask that I think that was the concern. That was what I was hearing. And I could certainly get him to supply whatever information. But I would submit to you that what I heard, as I said, was it's vis-a-vis who exerts the privilege. And under the disciplinary code, the client can waive it. I'm not confident under the 9.1, the way it's written now, that the client could waive it if the lawyer didn't want to.
Representative Bell.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a much lighter weight question. Back on page 1, line 24, in regards to fit to practice law, there's a definition for what lack of good moral character is on the next page, but it doesn't define what fit to practice law is. Would you define that for me?
Well, that's a good question. Fitness to practice law, I guess it would, we'd have to look back at the cases that have been decided under the existing standard. And this standard is already in, as I mentioned, the bar rules of procedure and the admission rules. And I think the things that have been looked to are criminal convictions. We had one gentleman that had been convicted of murder in Wisconsin, and he applied for admission here. And the question was, did he have good moral character? Was he fit to practice? Did he have appropriate credentials? And the court determined that in that particular instance, he had not really conceded his culpability, even following his conviction, and had not really accepted the notion of reformation. And so they denied his application for admission under those circumstances, though someone can reapply and again present their credentials and hopefully show that they have acknowledged their culpability and are making amends and are reformed and can then practice, can be trusted to practice law in this state. So it's, I guess, a combination of factors, but you look to their ability to be objective and fair, honest in their dealings with the client and the general public.
Well, it seems like that's been described in the good moral character. It talks about honest, fairness, respect for the rights of others, and laws of the state and nation. I'm wondering why you need to include that if it's not defined or if it's within that definition of good moral character.
I guess you can possibly have good moral character and not necessarily be fit to practice. You may have an inability to be fair and objective to people, and I guess it may not necessarily. Right. Yeah, I guess it's a subjectivity. I think you can show that maybe you have good moral character, but may not necessarily be fit based on other types of conduct. But it has to be. It's a relational thing. It's not just someone's subjective determination that you're not, you shouldn't be a member of the bar. It has to be connected to what is required of lawyers, and that is specified in other statutory requirements.
Thank you. Representative Bell, is that?
No. It's.
Oops.
Probably want to see
Mr.
them.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Oh,
we got Representative Mannix next. It says Representative Bell is done. Are you done, Representative Bell?
I guess I would just add, I'd be happy to show you maybe a list of the cases that have come up in the last few years concerning people who had applied and had a screening procedure applied to their situation so you can get an idea of what has kept people out and what has permitted people to come in.
In the statutory references.
Well, what you're saying is fit to practice law is a term of art that's been developed by the court over the years in a line of cases. It might help Representative Bell if you provided her with those cases because it's impossible for us to codify every nuance of fitness. And if we start codifying it, the next thing you know, the court's going to tell us, well, that's an exclusive list. Then our answer to that would be to say, well, including but not limited to, and in which case the list is only a series of examples anyway, and we've already got case law to tell us what it's all about. Why do we need examples in the statute? That's a statement, not a question. My question had to do with Representative Edmondson's concern. Do you have any idea how long this provision has been in the Act and section, which will be amended in ORS 9.460, about maintaining inviolate the confidence and at every peril to the attorney, preserve the secrets of the clients of the attorney?
How long that particular subsection
sounds
3.
Sounds like DD code stuff.
I think it is DD code stuff.
And
there has been that existing inconsistency or, I guess, potential peril since we adopted the Code of Professional Responsibility, actually even before then, because we had canons of professional ethics or legal ethics that preceded the code, but It's a recent dilemma that we felt we should try to solve for the benefit of the membership. They shouldn't be uncertain.
My problem is the DD code reflects an error when the lawyer was an extension of the client, the lawyer as gladiator, the lawyer as lonely warrior, whatever. And these days we've recognized through a variety of statutes the role of the lawyer as public servant, officer of the court, someone who has a variety of other obligations, not just obligations to get the client off or to take care of the client's needs. And I recognize what you're trying to do here is to say, well, we can deal with this in the Code of Professional Responsibility. My question, I'm coming back around to another question here, is I had promised that I wouldn't fool around with amending this bill, but if you're going to run into problems and we're going to be talking about having to deal with this issue and we're going to amend it anyway, then I would want to talk about some sort of language that would say, maintain the confidences of the client at the request of the client, subject to the limitations established by the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Supreme Court through the Code of Professional Responsibility. That kind of phraseology would allow us to hold out to the public that in the statutory scheme, we're still recognizing the need for confidences, but at the same time that there are exceptions, and you had better look to the profession and to the courts for those exceptions. What do you think about that?
Well, I like that a little bit better than I think maybe Representative Johnson's proposal, but I think they're both addressing the basic same concern.
Which one was that, to shoot all lawyers?
No, I'm a little concerned about trying to codify disciplinary rules, and I think your approach would more or less to say consistent with the Code of Professional Responsibility, and I would have less problem with that than the other approach. But don't forget, 9.460 is a disciplinary statute, and I think we've had some confusion about the fact that people feel that somehow we're repealing the attorney-client privilege. It's an entirely separate issue under a separate statute, and this is just a disciplinary standard, and we just want one consistent disciplinary standard, and we already have recognized exceptions that have been in existence for 19 years and have worked quite well. And I think that would aid lawyers to be able to look to one spot to say, okay, this is when I can reveal information. This is when I don't have to be a gladiator.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Coming back to the line of questioning that Representative Edmondson was asking you about, 9460 sub 4 under current law, an attorney shall never reject for any personal consideration the cause of the defenseless or the oppressed. Now, I don't know very many people that have spent more time and energy doing pro bono work than I have, and I just about got kicked out of my law firm for doing so much. But we don't honor that. The bar disciplinary statute says that I can be disbarred for willful violation of that provision. We don't.
they should go beyond, that they should get special treatment under the traditional tort law, under which they were never held liable. I mean, they don't have any case where they were held liable.
Traditional tort law or the federal statute?
The federal statute, I think we're, you know, if we took a vote of our organization, they'd probably side with Osberg and so forth, but I'm not sure that they feel particularly strongly. I mean, just the CERCLA aspects of it, I think they probably would be on the side of the DEQ and trying to work out something for maintaining a parallel standard with the federal law. But again, that's not our, you know, I hesitate to go outside of our main sphere of concern down here and stomp around to other people's gardens.
Is there some, during your lunch yesterday, did you talk about possible language that could get at some of your concerns, or is that just, I mean, are we just talking about a canyon that can't be crossed?
Well, you know, I suggested, I don't want to go into what our discussions were particularly because of that.
I guess all I'm saying is I can look at some of the things that you mentioned, and I can at least dream up some language that I think makes it better from your perspective, probably worse from their perspective, but still might be a reasonable compromise. But there's no interest in it. You know, it's not worth doing that if ultimately it doesn't make anybody happy. I mean, it just...
Our association's primary concern is with personal injuries. While property damage is important, some suggestions I have, and I think the bankers really should speak for their own selves on what they feel. But I mean, I would suggest a possibility of exempting personal injuries from the liability exemptions given under tort law under the bill. Simply saying this bill does not apply to common law rights, but applies only to the CERCLA, would make it much more acceptable for our members. Things such as that I would throw out. The bankers, I think, need to speak for themselves. But my feeling was that they feel very strongly they need this bill pretty much the way it is.
Yeah, and I mean, there's nothing to be said for splitting the baby for the sake of splitting the baby, but if it's decent policy. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Hey, Charlie, just a question. Is the position of the OTLA, is this a legal position or more of an environmental position? Which one are we here?
It's the principal position that people should bear responsibility for their own negligence, that the people should bear responsibility for their own, for strict liability under the traditional tort system when they possess hazardous substances and make a knowing election to do so, and that protection, I think, of the civil justice system is their overriding concern.
Okay, thank you.
I want to congratulate Mr. Williamson on getting lunch out of the bankers. That's pretty good. I've never been able to do that.
Mr. Bronner, we'd like to invite you and whomever else we'd like to bring up with you to come on up to grace us with your presence. We'd like you to address the comment Mr. Williamson did. I guess Representative Clark echoed about banks not loaning money. Don't loan money unless the customer doesn't need it. I deserve that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. I did not know that I bought lunch yesterday for Mr. Williams. And I agree with his last comment. We totally agree with his last comment. We believe that people should bear responsibility for their own negligence, particularly in the area of hazardous waste. And I guess I'd say that's what this bill is all about. Quick refresher, this is about credit availability, our opportunity to extend credit to be a part of the solution rather than part of the problem. We don't want to create orphan sites, and that's what we're doing. We want to approach this problem on a positive basis rather than negative. I want to also remind the committee that it is a two-part bill. There is lending on the first part and fiduciary on the second part. Both have unique problems, somewhat different. I also agree that this is special treatment for special interests, our borrowers, our depositors, our shareholders, but it goes beyond banking. This is not a banking bill. If you read the lenders, if you read the definition of fiduciary, It goes far beyond banking, and that is one of the problems that Mr. Hansen spoke to. Now, we're going to try to respond to what we've heard this afternoon, and obviously we've had a lot of time for rehearsal. I want to take the EPA rules that may be forthcoming and whether we should wait. You see, if the rules come and there's no federal legislation, Mr. Chair, we're still left with not the opportunity to legislate when this legislature goes home. You understand our two-year problem and trying to deal with this. Mr. Hansen said that if we passed 3349 and there was no action on the federal level, it would make little difference. Well, let us tell you what we said yesterday when we met with Mr. Hansen. And I'm going to ask Ann Hill from First Interstate to respond to that and to say to you what we said yesterday to him.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Identify yourself, please.
My name's Ann Hill. I'm one of the attorneys for First Interstate Bank of Oregon. In our meeting yesterday, Fred and I also discussed that we do think that it might make a difference with regard to what I believe we termed in the meeting the small stuff, where banks may be willing to take a little bit greater risk if the risk that they are taking isn't quite so large. We also discussed that I believe that the attitude of the banks is going to be determined in great part by the attitude of Fred on behalf of DEQ. If this bill passes, and Fred's attitude is that the legislature has spoken and this is what the legislature in Oregon wants the law in Oregon to be, and he will abide by that and work within the spirit of that, then I think the banks will be encouraged, despite the fact that federal legislation may not yet have passed. If, on the other hand, Frank says, by God, I didn't want that legislation to pass, I'm mad about it, and now I'm going to shove the federal law down your throat, then clearly the banks are going to step back, and passage of this bill isn't going to make any bit of difference.
Mr. Chair. Representative Clark.
I take a little bit of offense at the comment.
I apologize.
I think it's fair for this committee to assume that any head of any major state agency is going to comply with state law. And I take offense to the comment.
Oh, Representative Clark, I certainly didn't mean any offense. And I think that the nature of my comment is that all lawyers, and certainly bank lawyers in Oregon, recognize that the federal law is equally available to any person in Oregon with regard to the hazardous substances laws. It is a matter of policy choice which law anybody decides to sue under. And the federal law is always available and will remain available.
But if this legislature determines that for whatever reason wants to go one step further, I think we can safely assume that the agency given responsibility for carrying that out will do so.
I'm certainly pleased to hear that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are you done, Ms. Miller? Are you done?
Yes, thank you very much.
We don't want to interrupt you too much there, but go ahead. Mr. Bonner, do you have a comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, let's assume that the federal law passes, either the Grind bill or the LaFalce bill, and there was no Oregon counterpart. We'd have the same problem in reverse. In other words, we would have to wait until we could speak in Oregon, because then the Oregon law could be used, even though CERCLA and the federal law had been handled, they'd spoken in Washington. Now, I want to talk about the business of personal liability, and I don't know whether who's going to do that.
Mr. Chair, Dave Ellis. I guess I'm going to do that.
Good, Mr. Ellis. Go ahead and identify yourself. We always like the willing volunteers in this business.
Thank you. Personal injury is certainly something that wasn't, when we were drafting this bill, I have to admit, we weren't thinking a lot about personal injury, because banks' big problems in this area have to do with property damage and the costs of cleanup of property damage. Nevertheless, in trying to to craft a way to exempt that out of this bill, I would want to urge caution. It would be very difficult to craft something that would deal with cleanup levels that have yet to be established by the state. Let me paint a scenario. A bank, after passage of this act, takes it upon themselves to clean up a site, but and does that in accordance with guidance from the DEQ to levels that are acceptable to the DEQ. And 15 years later, because of that cleanup, it's alleged that since it could have gone further, someone contracts some horrible disease or something like that. The levels for cleanup are not well established. They're not well documented that you should do it to this level instead of this level. In fact, today it's to background, which is sort of an undefined level. And I think what it is for this legislature is a question of balancing of policy choices here, a balancing of whether it is more beneficial to have the lenders available as a source of funding to do this type of cleanups, or to have lenders available to redress a type of personal injury for which, as far as I know, there has not been a case in this state. It is something that certainly in any sort of parade of horribles, somebody could say, well, what if this or what if that? But I think it's an unlikely occurrence.
Thank you. Mr. Ross. Representative Bryan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bronner or anyone on the panel, could you clarify for us this question that I raised with Mr. Yes. Hansen? The intent of the bill is to section, I guess let's pick Section 3. As I understood, the original testimony was to secure the liability protection in those cases where strictly a security interest is involved, not where you're managing the property after a foreclosure, for example. And I think the point was advanced that particularly Section 3.1 sub A is broader than that and allows or attempts to achieve the liability protection even in the case of control and management of the property, on, for example, foreclosure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, I want to respond and then let one of my experts, the certified smart people, respond. The intent is that if we are in management and we can well find ourselves there, we can be on the site temporarily or have hired somebody, an agent can be operating for us. And if we screw up, we're just like anybody else. That's the intent. But just because we're there and had no, it wasn't by our choice to be there, and there has been a spill that's occurred prior to that, we're not responsible.
Mr. Brown, why don't we, let me just get right to the point of that. Let's say we have a receiver appointed. You know how we do in foreclosures. Pending the outcome of the foreclosure, you appoint someone to manage the property, take the rents, whatever you do. It seems to indicate that the controls are managed pursuant to the terms of extension of credit. Prior to the foreclosure, actually transferring legal title over, you get this temporary order. Is that addressed anywhere else in the bill, that, or is it the liability of what a receiver might have in that situation? Mr. Sherman, maybe you know.
And maybe in answering that question, can you tie in the definition of extension of credit to that? It would help me if you could.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm Ken Sherman, Jr., representing the Oregon Bankers Association, and I'll get started on this. I'm kind of the certified half-smart. I'm a little bit more generalist than the others here at the table
or
on this
half,
issue.
Or half-certified.
Half-certified. About half through the session, too. At any rate, I can certainly understand, and we've had some conversations as the others who have testified on this bill about the concern about some of this language. It is our intent and our design, as we previously testified, to cover not the sham transaction which has been described and for which various scenarios may be reported, but to cover the situation where you've got a lender or another extender of credit, and that term, as Representative Clark has indicated, is defined in the bill very specifically, and I'll get to that in a minute, to cover that situation where that lender has some relationship to the property and is acting with respect to that relationship in dealing with the property. Now, the receivership question, I think that's a good example of where, in my understanding and reading of the bill, it would be covered. It would be subject to Section 3. Why would we do that? Why would we think it appropriate to limit the liability of the lender under those circumstances? Simply because we believe that presently, without that protection against liability, there are things happening out there with regard to contaminated properties that are not in the interests of society. Those properties are being abandoned. They're not being addressed by financially responsible parties. And we think that if you really balance the equities, what's really in interest of society, that this gets closer. It doesn't go all the way. It doesn't give us an absolute shield against liability. And it's certainly not our intent to give any shield for the sham, but it is intended to take the legitimate lending situation and all of the various ways that that can exist and provide us with a limited shield against liability so that we can get in, finance the cleanup, take possession of the property. We believe that we'll deal with that property more responsibly than the person who polluted it, and we think that's appropriate from a social standpoint. Now, that's my response to the 3A part. Maybe we can go to the question that Representative Clark raised about the definition of extension of credit. Is there a particular concern there that I can address, Representative?
No, you hit on it in your answer, which is in response to the chair's question, how the definition of extension of credit applies to that, to the question he was raising. I think you hit on it in your response.
I think if I can, Mr. Chairman, speak just a little bit more with respect to the concern that has been expressed about the sham transaction. That certainly is a concern for us. We don't want to be party to legislation which creates a loophole in the laws that have been very carefully crafted to protect the public against this kind of problem. By the same token, I feel very confident that if you look at the existing state and federal Superfund laws, you can concoct scenarios under those existing statutes where you can have a sham. I mean, there is a supposed protection for lenders under the existing law. The problem is that it has been so narrowly interpreted by the courts in the last few years, and you look particularly to some of the cases that have already been alluded to, that it no longer exists. It no longer gives us any confidence to do the things that we think are socially responsible. And I'm absolutely certain, as I sit here today, that the sham that might be concocted under the existing law or under this bill is going to be looked at very, very critically by any court. The courts have demonstrated, I think almost without exception, their vigilance in looking for people who really ought not to be given the opportunity to take advantage of any exceptions in the law. I think that vigilance will continue in the courts.
Mr. Sherman, let me ask your question. I think what we have is subparagraph A on section, subparagraph B under section 3. It more addresses what happens if you acquire through foreclosure. Now, I'm pretty satisfied with that being a delineation. The other one is controls or manages. With that subparagraph, with B following A, it seems to say, well, now this is the topic of foreclosure we're going to cover under B. But it seems to state there that acquired through foreclosure and held for purpose of disposition and satisfaction of the foreclosed obligation. Talks about a fait accompli. Now, I don't want to tinker with this bill very much, but would it be a problem to say that acquired after the commencement of foreclosure action and held for purposes of disposition and satisfaction of the foreclosed obligation? Does that do violence to what the banks and, it means that once you file that complaint and you get that order for that receivership and they put you in charge, any time from then on in that the bank comes into control of the property and it then has a obligation to be careful that it doesn't contribute to the cause. And this would quiet some of the fears I hear from people about. But again, if it does violence to the intent of the bill, I'm not interested, but it seemed to address some of the concerns. He'd had the same language down on line 37 where you state, obtains actual knowledge of a release or threatened release of, at a facility required acquired after the commencement of a foreclosure action that may pose a significant threat. Now, if you know.
Chair, I believe Mr. Ellis is ready to respond.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that the concept does any sort of damage to our intent here. We'd have to look carefully at the way we've described foreclosure, because commencement of an action, to me, means that yeah. there's some sort of judicial proceeding or even a non-judicial proceeding, maybe. But this foreclose also includes acceptance of a deed in lieu of foreclosure, and that happens.
We leave the foreclosed language in there. We just started off with
it.
But if we were to say after commencement of an action,
You could change that. I mean, you could monkey that language around a little bit, Mr. Chair.
Well, I just want to see if we can address some of the concerns that some of the members have about that being a little bit.
Mr. Chair, I guess our response is conceptually we can understand. We can agree to that.
Mr. Chair, yeah. You could use the phrase "process resulting in" or some such thing.
Definitely, there'd be a way to do it. I think we just want to monkey with the language a little bit, make sure that we've covered the different types of judicial and non-judicial foreclosure remedies.
Representative Maddox.
I think part of the answer here may lie in going back through the process that you get, through which you get to this provision, because you've got to go back and look at how carefully lender has been defined. You need to go back and look and see that we're saying that no lender shall be liable under any law creating strict liability. Because we didn't say you're not going to be under any liable any law in regard to gross negligence or negligence, general liability kinds of standards. We're only talking about strict liability here. And once we're that narrow, then we drop into acquired through foreclosure. And when you look at the definition of foreclosure, that is pretty narrow. And then we have the conjunctive here and held for purposes of disposition. It's not a disjunctive. Once we get there, it seems to me we've already narrowed this provision down pretty far. My concern would be, I realize this is a pretty comprehensively drafted bill, if we start fiddling with this phraseology, acquired through foreclosure had a consistent meaning through here, and I think we hit a trip lever, and we start tripping over all these other phrases. Isn't the little mind game that I just went through, or the exercise I just went through, doesn't that show, though, that this is a fairly narrow provision anyway?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I think it absolutely does. I think it took me a long time once we had this draft put together to even be able to think in a cohesive whole about it, because you really do have to work very carefully through those definitions. If you take any piece of this out of context, it looks enormously broad. But if you really focus on what you have to do to get to each part of the bill, I think you're exactly right. It is narrowly and carefully crafted.
Well, for instance, we have the concept of personal injury thrown out here. Well, gee, if there's someone who's injured in the course of a cleanup, that's not a strict liability action. Well, some people might want it to be, but normally you'll have the standard personal injury cause of action. And I'm not aware as to whether or not the cleanup law says that there is strict liability for someone who falls off a truck during the process of cleanup. I don't think it went that far.
I think that's correct.
Mr. Sherman or Mr. Bronner, I guess that's an appropriate comment. We have the definition of foreclosure. It doesn't say receivership in that foreclosure definition, but it talks about acquiring possession to the property. If it helps clarify some of the members concerned, we'll do it. If it doesn't and it causes more problems, we won't. But I just want to raise that as an issue. We could add receiverships by receivership as one of the things you get under the foreclosure definition. You get property by receivership. Whatever. Mr. Ellis.
Mr. Chair, one thing, and you probably, I'm sure you haven't overlooked this, and maybe it doesn't speak to your concern, but under the fiduciary section of this bill, receivers are protected. So the receiver themselves has protection. So I'm probably missing the point there, but.
Further comments, Representative Clark.
Mr. Sherman, if you look at Section 3, subsection 3, that's on page 4, lines 9 and 10. Nothing in subsection 1 or 2 of this section shall relieve a person from liability arising out of its ownership, operation, custody, or control of a facility in a capacity other than as a lender. I think I know what that's supposed to be.